Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, November 8th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Scott Beck and Brian Woods' new movie, Heretic, and we'll present an interview with Beck and Woods. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
I want to say a quick thank you real quick to the listeners who wrote in responding to Wednesday's episode. We only had one person who seemed disgusted and said that they would never listen again, but there were a ton of people who took time to say that they appreciated the message. So thank you to those folks. Okay, let's get into it, Jacob. We're here to talk about Heretic, which you saw all the way back at Fantastic Fest. You reviewed the movie for the site. I'm going to put a link to your review in the show notes so people can check out maybe some of your more detailed thoughts there. But let's get into sort of general thoughts about the movie before we dive into spoilers. What do you think about this one?
I think Heretic is terrific. In my review, I call the first hour of it the best horror film of 2024, and the second hour very, 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 very good. I'm curious to see if you agree with me, because I think that the first half is so frightening and so unique in how it mines tension out of dialogue and three people in a series of rooms, that I am maybe only a smidge disappointed that the back half goes to more traditional territory. But even then, the more traditional stuff is still, in my opinion, quite good and quite exciting and quite scary. But man, that first hour is just some of my favorite horror filmmaking all year. I love that first hour, like, to the extreme. How do you feel about the movie structure?
Yeah, I actually agree with that. And I think it gets really ridiculous without getting into spoilers yet. It gets pretty ridiculous as the movie goes on. And I think in a lesser movie, it gets so ridiculous that I would have checked out. But I think the work that this movie does in its first half got me so on board that it was able to carry me through to the end, if that makes sense. So, I just think that first section is so strong. And it's really so simple, too. It's not even like a ton of filmmaking flourishes or anything. It's really just the script and these characters like having their faith interrogated by this guy who, played by Hugh Grant, Mr. Reed is his character's name. And he is basically like the ultimate reply guy or something, you know, like it reminds me a little bit of Jude Law in the first Captain Marvel movie being like, debate me, remember? I don't know. There's something about that character, which I think is meant to be repulsive. Like we are repulsed by figures like that in our actual society, but there's something about Hugh Grant's performance and the way that this character is written, where even though I know that he's the bad guy, I mean, the trailer makes that very clear. There's something compelling about him. There's something mesmerizing about this guy that I kind of couldn't help myself in falling under his spell a little bit. So,
I talk about this in the interview you'll hear, but I said, like, I found myself nodding along with a lot of his bullshit, which is a really compelling thing. Like, it makes you, in the same interview, they talk about how they research cult leaders, and it really makes sense, the idea of this guy who's charismatic and compelling and clearly very intelligent, but also up his own butt in a serious, dangerous way, that you listen to him, and because he's Hugh Grant, and because he's charming, and because he has that accent, and because certain things that he is saying do make a lot of sense, mm-hmm. that you kind of get drawn to him before you realize, oh no, this guy's bad news. Oh no. Which is a really exciting dynamic to have with a villain. And I think that Hugh Grant is doing some of my all-time favorite Hugh Grant work here. He lures us in by being the charming goofball that we know him to be for, you know, decades before he like starts like bringing in different sinister layers bit by bit by bit until he's unrecognizable. But I do think he's really balanced by Sophie Thatcher and Chloe East, who are the two Mormon missionaries who come into his home and find out they cannot leave and are forced to navigate a series of spaces with this potentially dangerous man. I wrote this in my review, and I'm worried hyperbolic, but I feel very strong about it. I think they're my favorite original horror heroes since Ed and Lorraine Warren from the first Conjuring movie. I think that they're just so, they would have survived so many other horror movies because they're so capable and smart. Mm-hmm. And I like spending time with them, and I like watching them find ways to navigate their very bad day with Mr. Reed.
Yeah. So obviously there's a whole faith-based ecosystem, a film market with distributors and production companies that make movies specifically for Christian audiences in the United States. But it's pretty unusual to see a mainstream Hollywood movie, something outside of those confines, center religion in the way that this movie does. So I was curious what you thought about the way the movie handled that topic, which is typically like, you know, one of those things that you're not supposed to talk about in polite society or whatever.
Yeah. I'm going to risk maybe ruffling a feather or two, and I apologize. I was raised Catholic. I'm not religious now. But I fundamentally believe in a lot of the basic teachings of New Testament Christianity of, you know, respect other people, take care of other people, you know, help the poor, try to, you know, make the world a better place. So I have a complicated relationship with this kind of material, which is why I like wrestling with it. And when I say all this, because I think that the Christian filmmaking industry is largely insulting toward Christians. They make movies that offer no challenge, offer no conversation, and exist to simply affirm, yes, you are 100% right. Everybody else is wrong. Go about your day. Question nothing. Whereas you have filmmakers like Martin Scorsese, who is deeply Christian and deeply Catholic, who makes movies that are full of his faith, but often depict characters who are at odds with his beliefs and odds with the teachings of, you know, his religion. And he uses that to like truly explore and interrogate why he believes in things and what evil is, what good is, and to really get people of all faiths and beliefs or non-beliefs having the conversation about what is right and what is wrong. And I'm not saying Heretic is a Martin Scorsese movie. It's even 8 out of 10. Like, it's a great time of the movie, and I can't wait to see it again. But this is the kind of movie that exists to allow people who are secular and people who are religious to generally engage in debate about what it means to believe and what it means to have faith in 2024. Mm-hmm. I wish that this was what Christian filmmaking regularly was.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I think it's thought-provoking, and it reminds me of the first time that I took college classes, where the movie lays out sort of the history of religion and the evolution of religion over thousands of years. And, you know, as somebody who I was also raised in the church growing up, and like when I encountered that information for the first time, it was this really mind blowing thing. So I don't know how many other people have already been, have already interrogated their own faith to a degree where they've already discovered that stuff. I imagine it would be a pretty decent percentage of people, but maybe there are some where this movie is the first time that they've had that information presented to them in that way. And that can be a really challenging thing and a really interesting test of faith and a sort of grappling with what you really believe and why you believe it. And this movie is really interested in those questions. And it all comes down to this sort of individual, personalized thing. And I like how the movie doesn't really try to put its finger on the scale a lot, because of the way that these Mormon missionary characters respond to the situation. I think there's an interpretation here where it's not just looking down at people who are religious, which I think could be a fairly easy thing to do. The movie has a little bit of nuance about that position. So I think it handles it pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, I won't spoil anything here, but the events of the movie really support somebody who is religious to say this movie is about the power of faith, and somebody who's not religious can watch and say, no, this movie's about the power of human determination and making your own choices in the face of danger. And I think both are completely valid. I think you can walk away having that conversation instead of feeling like, you know, we've been told one thing or the other.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into some spoilers here. Actually, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about spoilers for Heretic.
88% of the workweek is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI.
All right. So, Jacob, we alluded to this earlier, the fact that the movie, once they go through the belief or disbelief door, they make the decision there, it becomes kind of a different movie. And this is where I found the movie to get a little bit ridiculous, like the idea of this man having built this cavernous space and seems to be just like a normal town. I forget what town they're in Colorado. But like the questions about how this happened and what he's using this for and like how many other people have gone through this kind of twisted experiment that he's doing. And like the, you know, the sort of logic, if you will, of this movie, I think, like I said earlier, would have just completely cut me off to what it was trying to do if the rest of it wasn't so well told. So what did you make of like the back half of the movie? You said you thought it was still effective, right?
Yeah, I think the first half of the movie is like a 10 out of 10 experience, and the second half, like, you know, in 7.5 out of 10, if you want to use a slash film rating scale. The second half reminds me a lot of Beckinwood's previous film, one of the previous films, Haunt, which is about a haunted house staffed by actual serial killers who start picking off the visitors one by one, which is a really fun, really grimy, really nasty thriller. And I really like it. And I also really like 65, their Adam Driver dinosaur movie that is just awesome and nobody saw it. I thought I liked these guys a lot, by the way. But I think that they, we talked about this in the interview, so I don't want to say too much. I think these guys like to please the audience. I think these guys have a natural instinct to send audiences out on a high and have a natural desire to get audiences like screaming and laughing and cheering. And the first half of the movie, which is entirely philosophical and full and like powered by just pure dread, is not in the kind of thing that sends the audience out screaming. And I think that they are filmmakers who want the audience to come out screaming. So they go to a more traditional route and it's ridiculous and it doesn't make a lot of sense. You think about the logistics of it, but it's undeniably effective as a thriller to watch, you know, Hugh Grant stalk people throughout his many, many grimy, you know, tunnels. as long as you don't think too hard about it. If you want to get metaphorical, you know, like literally they've descended into a literal hell on earth, which, you know, once again, points for the religious category there. But yeah, it is ridiculous, but it's also very fun because I think Beck and Woods are just such strong filmmakers and Hugh Grant is so scary and Thatcher and East are such compelling, likable protagonists that I'm willing to overlook the logic of it to appreciate just the visceral thrills that it brings, which are really handily delivered. Do I wish the back half was as cerebral as the front half? Yes, absolutely. I think this would have been my favorite horror movie of the year if the back half like had found a way to maintain that dialogue-driven tension throughout the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the back half is still like a great audience pleaser of a horror movie. And I don't know, maybe that's in the same way that it makes Heretic a fun movie. Whereas I don't think it would have been like a Hereditary type experience. If you want to compare it to another A24 horror movie, where you watch it and you appreciate it and you're maybe immersed by it, but you're like, man, I love that, but I also don't think I can watch it again. And the back half here, makes me go, man, Heretic was fun. I can't wait to watch Heretic again. I recommend Heretic to everybody. Which I can't do with Hereditary.
Right.
So it's a double-edged sword of, I think they made a clear and conscious choice to make a movie that was a bit more accessible. At the risk of maybe losing us snobs a little bit, I think they probably are going to win over a lot more casual audiences, and maybe that's the right choice.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So I want to talk to you about the ending. I have multiple interpretations of the ending, and I think BJ actually wrote an Ending Explained article that lays out some of these theories. So I have three things that I wanted to bring up here. So one option or interpretation is that Sister Paxton actually dies in the basement, and Sister Barnes never saved her by smashing Mr. Reed's head in with that wooden plank with the nails in it. And Paxton's vision of escaping the house is just her version of entering the kingdom of heaven. So that's one. Another interpretation is that Barnes does not save Paxton. She actually died when we saw her die on screen. And instead, Paxton is actually the one who somehow saves herself, kills Mr. Reed in some way. And she just imagines someone else killing Mr. Reed as a coping mechanism, you know, that sort of trauma type of moment or response. And then the third one is that the events play out exactly as we see. And the only real interpretation that needs to be done comes down to the butterfly on Paxton's hand at the end of the movie, which the movie sort of handles in this interesting way by showing it present in one shot and then not there in the next shot. And I think the filmmakers would really love for us to be talking about whether or not the final shot, which in my memory does not show the butterfly, is like the real version of the ending. But I was curious what you made of these interpretations, or if you had another one.
I was actually talking to BJ as she was writing her article about the ending. Here and I were talking. She asked me, like, what's your take on it? Because she wanted to see if we aligned. And we largely did. I think that the read is that this all happens as seen, because Heretic is not full of hallucinations, not full of dream sequences. Every single thing we see in this movie is presented as being an event that's happening. There's never a point where it's tricking us or trying to deceive us. So I go with my gut that this movie is presenting a series of events that are completely existing in the world of the film, as opposed to the minds of other people. So this means that the seemingly dead character does come back to life or rise back up to kill Mr. Reed, and the other one does escape and see a butterfly in her hand. I think that all happens. The question is this a case of a miracle? Was there a miracle? What did like Lazarus, does she rise from the dead to save a friend and give her a chance to escape? Or does she will herself to get back up with the last bit of her life because it's the right thing to do to save your friend? Mm-hmm. And that's either the, do you believe in faith or do you believe in human willpower? And I think both are incredibly viable reads based on how you choose to take this. Same with the butterfly. Is that just a butterfly landed on her? Or is that representative of what she talked about earlier about how she would visit somebody if she died, let them know that she was okay? And I think that it's intentionally left open to be, to encourage a conversation we're having now, which is, did we witness a religious miracle in these moments, or did we just see somebody rise up to save their friend?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so totally. Yeah. And I think this is what I was talking about, where the movie is kind of, it's generous to people who actually have faith in the real world. You know, it would have been really, really easy to come down in a clear way about the ending of the movie. And to me, this is kind of similar to like the ending of Inception, which I think, you know, like literally trying to answer these questions is not really the point of this movie, I think, but it's kind of like an underlining of the themes and the messages that we just saw in the film. So yeah, just really good stuff. Super entertaining movie. I really, really enjoyed this a lot. So I'm glad you got a kick out of it, Jacob. Any closing thoughts before we go to your interview with Scott Beck and Brian Woods?
No real closing thoughts other than to say that I hope you guys enjoyed this interview. Beck and Woods are clearly movie fans. Sometimes you talk to directors and you get the nagging suspicion that they don't watch a lot of movies, that they like they're only interested in their own work. But Beck and Woods, man, these guys freaking love movies. Like, I could have talked to them. If you could say, hey, take an extra half hour just to chat about movies, I think we could have. I think they're probably best known for writing A Quiet Place, the first one, before they started directing their own stuff. But I don't know. I just feel very strong that these two are like some of the most exciting voices in like accessible genre of filmmaking right now. I mean, the fact that 65 was a box office bomb is a shame, because that movie is like so finely honed to like be a good time. And I think Heretic, despite being an A24 horror movie, it's dialogue driven, is still finely honed to be a good time. These guys make movies that are fun and just really respect the audience. And I'm a big Beck and Woods fan, Ben.
Excellent. All right. Well, here is Jacob's conversation with Scott Beck and Brian Woods.
Hi guys, how's it going? Movie's fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate that.
That means a lot to us.
So I want to talk about like the literal technical aspect of filming dialogue scenes, because so much of this film is talking. And as filmmakers, how do you look at a scene and say, okay, this dialogue is going on for 5, 10, 15 minutes. How do you keep it interesting? How do you approach it as visual filmmakers?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the first and foremost approach is character-centric, like understanding who are the characters that we're kind of focusing on from their perspective, and how are we feeling emotional with them? So, you know, a scene in Heretic, for instance, like the initial living room scene where Sister Pax and Sister Barnes first meet Mr. Reed, Hugh's character, you know, we want to make it feel very open. Like, this is a very open space. It's not claustrophobic. Everybody feels welcome here. And so you're shooting it more from wides. But slowly the camera starts creeping in as for instance, as Reed starts singling out each of the sisters, he's trying to like hone in on them psychologically. And so we're creeping closer and closer. And in doing that, especially over the course of the film, allowing the camera to have a little more motion. So at first, like in this film, it starts off a little dull, a little the camera's in stasis, but as we go deeper into the house, as we go deeper into the danger, the camera starts to
It
move.
was one of our biggest fears because it's such a chamber piece. It's so dialogue heavy. The experiment with this film, it was almost the opposite of what we were attempting to do with A Quiet Place. A Quiet Place was like a modern day silent film, so it was all about pure cinema. This was, can we can we replace jump scares and monsters hiding in shadows with dialogue and philosophical ideas? Can we actually take a conversation about religion, and those are the scares. Like the dialogue, the lines themselves are the scares in the movie. And so that's when you hire, Chung Hoon Chung, who shot Old Boy and in It and Last Night in Soho, and one of the great cinematographers in cinema history, to help us drag the dread out of every single frame of the movie, while our characters are debating theology.
One of the most interesting and frightening things about Mr. Reed is that I find myself, especially in the first half of the movie, kind of nodding along with what he's saying. So
Good.
what's the trick to writing a villain who is the villain, but you kind of find yourself going, maybe this guy has a point?
I think the trick is he's saying the quiet parts out loud, the things that we've all felt in our bones, or the things that we've had conversations with friends, behind closed doors about. True beliefs or true questions about things that otherwise outwardly maybe we put ourselves in uncertainty when we otherwise discuss them. And I think trying to be as personal as possible, the ideas that this movie starts to grapple with is what happens when you die? What is there an afterlife? Is there nothing? Those are very real fears that Brian and I have had and have had many conversations about. And it's a very, very human tendency to want comfort in the anticipation of what happens when you die, whether you find that comfort in following a religion or some other output. These are all things that we felt like Reed could be speaking a degree of truth, in terms of what we've all kind of like thought about, from an existential standpoint.
Was there ever a version of this movie that was entirely dialogue driven? Without spoiling things, it does at some point the fight, you get to the fireworks factory eventually. To use a reference, but was there ever a version where you wanted to push the dialogue even further, or did you always know, okay, at some point we're going to blow this up?
Well, I mean, listen, I both appreciate that you feel the fireworks factory gets ignited at a certain point, because we do want to deliver cinema, and this was never like a stage play to us. Like we are movie lovers, and we wanted a movie to play in a theater, and take the audience on a ride. But I will also say, like, to us, this the movie is it really is a dialogue from beginning to end. Even though the fireworks start to go off at a certain point, we are constantly keeping our characters in dialogue with each other all the way up until the final moments. Because there were different, I guess what I'm saying is there were different versions of this ending and movie and third act that were exclusively the kind of visceral visual thrills that you would maybe expect out of a horror film. And we felt, at least our ambition was, we always wanted to bring it back to the conversation, even in the third act. So that's what we're attempting to do.
So I revisited Haunt and 65 recently. I think they're all awesome movies. I have a great time with all of them. And I was trying to find like what's the connection between these films. And the one thing that like on a maybe a surface level is that I'm remind your movies remind me of a Christopher McQuarrie quote. I'm going to paraphrase, but how the audience is king. You make movies for the audience, not for yourself. And I'm wondering if that's true with you because I feel like you always make movies that like where you want to send the audience out buzzing. Is that how important is that to you?
We take it very seriously. I mean, I think, we are in the entertainment business. And so first and foremost, we want something that feels like a theatrical experience, that you want to go to a movie theater and sit there with hundreds of strangers and experience this thing, and also feel it percolate around the audience. And I think there's also a degree at which Brian and I, there's two of us. And so even in the writing phase, we're not writing in the same room. And so we're usually trading off scenes or sections of the script, and the other becomes the first audience for that movie. even in script stage. And so we want to constantly surprise each other. We want to subvert expectations. And so we're automatically thinking from an audience forward perspective that early in the process.
And it's funny because it's not something we've ever intellectualized or talked about. Like, do we, cause we write for ourselves too. There's like a personal kind of relationship we have with the material that we're trying to like thrill ourselves. But our production designer on Heretic, Phil Messina, who's one of our heroes. I mean, he's production design, anything from Aronofsky's Mother to the Hunger Games movies to Steven Soderbergh, like 12 Steven Soderbergh movies. And it was an observation he made working with us that he told one of our producers that he's never heard directors talk about the audience so much while directing. So it was subconscious that I guess that there is, we do love to serve an audience. And I guess it's just our deep love of going to the movies on a Friday night with a packed house.
I'm glad you brought the production design because the house in Heretic is fabulously designed. And in a movie that is contained to a handful of rooms, it has such an intentionally, you know, minor scope. What was the process of determining the look and feeling of each room? Because you can kind of break down the movie into Act One, Act Two, Act Three, based on rooms. Right. So what was it? What was the journey there?
Yeah, I mean, the initial journey, it mimicked the character of Mr. Reed as well, meaning you get into the first room and you see something that feels fairly inviting, fairly warm with the colors and the tones and the lighting. And then as you progress throughout the movie, it starts getting a little stranger by increments. You start picking up on small details, strange things like the doors once you get into the library sequence, and then it starts getting a little more raw and a little more dangerous and scary in the same way that Mr. Reed becomes that. And one thing that like Phil Messina, our production designer, is so genius about is being character forward and really enveloping every single decision that he makes into the larger scope of the character. Into the sound design, you know, from the ticking of the clocks to the ticking of the water and these devices, like the Shishi Adoshi inside the library that drips the water, and finding ways to accentuate the suspense and make sure there was an evolution over the course of the movie that feels organic and genuine, but also more and more suspenseful and off-putting.
You called the movie a chamber piece, and it did remind me a lot of the 50s and 60s horror films that you would have seen, like Vincent Price star, and it kind of clicked in my head that, oh man, if this was made in 1962, Vincent Price would have played the Hugh Grant character. Yeah. So I'm wondering how much Vincent Price is in Mr. Reed.
I mean, there is a degree that you are right on the money. You know, I think about the way that Hugh wanted to be fun, you know, with the role. Highly intellectual, but very, very charming as well. And I feel like you can look at Vincent Price and you can trace all those attributes. Even the sweater that her costume designer Betsy Hyman picked out, I feel like you could envision that in black and white on Vincent Price. And so, I mean, as students of horror since, you know, the beginning of the genre, in the 1920s, I mean, I think latently that feeds into everything that our fingerprints start putting itself on.
And I do think like mostly when we were talking about Reed, in particular with Hugh, there's just a lot of real life inspirations, oddly enough. Yeah. You can look at, you know, the kind of atheist thinkers out of the UK, like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens. There's American kind of cult leaders like Keith Raniere. We talked a lot about Keith Raniere of the Nexium cult and how he was able to kind of use this kind of odd, almost odd charm to kind of this ability to listen to kind of get people to do what he wants and to control them. And so there's a lot of real life influences intersecting with the kind of more showmanship of you know, a figure like Vincent Price.
In a recent interview, Hugh Grant described his current phase of his career as his freak show phase.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny, but also like undersells how good he's been over the past decade and yes. How interesting he's been. As an actor, like on that set, what is he like to direct during his freak show phase? Like, what is that process like right now?
He's great at underselling himself. To your point, he's a great underseller. Like working with Hugh is like, you know, he'll show up on set and he'll go, all right, well, you know, let's just do like a really bad, you know, just a bad version. No acting. We don't need to act. Like, we'll just say the lines. No, you know, it's not a big deal. Let's just say the lines. It'll be fine. And then he'll just, show you the most amazing performance you've ever seen and just crush take after take. There were scenes where, there'd be 10 pages of dialogue and we would kind of all amongst ourselves agree, all right, let's just do 5 pages, and 5 pages is like climbing Mount Everest. Let's just do 5 pages. Let's do half of it. It'll be fine. No pressure. And then he would crush it. He would go all the way through 10 pages, put a cherry on top. We'd call cut. The crew would burst out into applause. It felt like watching live theater. It felt like watching, Daniel Day-Lewis at the top of his game. It was really something special to see, and can't be more grateful for what he gave to this film.
So Sister Barnes and Sister Paxton are depicted as being really smart, canny characters. I imagine it's really difficult to write a horror movie where characters would outthink or escape an average horror movie plot much faster than these two did. So how would you escape the pitfalls of writing characters who are smart enough to escape the average horror movie, but not smart enough to escape your horror movie?
Yeah. I mean, I think the balance and the gut check that we have early on is being allergic to convention or being allergic to the obvious answer of how you get yourself out. So if you put your characters, I think we first encountered this when writing both Haunt and A Quiet Place, 7, 8, 9 years ago, where it's like you get your characters into situations and we as the writers or directors may know where we want to go next with them. But if the characters start pushing up against that and being like, no, I'm smarter than the next scene that you want to write, we try to follow that instinct. We try to make sure that we are being as genuine and surprising to ourselves during that early process as possible, so that we don't just, we're like, this character has to go into the next room, and so we're just going to write them going into the next room. It's like, no, if they need to go through the exercise of, this is dangerous, I need to try the door, I need to try the window first, they're going to do that. And we're going to have to engineer and try to think on our feet and be even push ourselves to be a little more ahead of these characters and the audience as possible. And what that usually brings up is like, we find ourselves in more unpredictable situations. And that's really where the exciting place is to start creating the scene and creating like the movie to surprise ourselves and go to the unexpected.
So kind of a silly question, but I have to ask. I feel like A24 horror movies become its own subgenre. Like somebody asked me, what's that movie like? Even if it's not A24 movie, in some ways, somebody asked me, what's Long Ladies like? It's like an A24 horror movie, even though it's neon. Yes. So I need to ask, what is the inside process of an A24 horror movie? Is there discussions about how their movies feel compared to others? I really need to know the process of making an A24 horror movie.
No, I mean, like having worked with them, like our feeling, they were one of our favorite studios, mm-hmm. just as film lovers. And now we can see being the behind the curtain, you can see why, which is basically they love movies. They support their filmmakers and they're ambitious. They want to do hard, challenging work. And that it does kind of personify the brand of A24 when you see their movies. But there's no there's no self-awareness of like, this is what we're really doing. I actually felt like it was the bravery. There's a moment. Every movie you make, there's kind of, especially when you're making studio films, but we've seen this even with like independent financiers, there's this kind of instinct to satisfy the audience to the detriment of the movie that you're making or the story that you're telling or the point that you're trying to make. There's this kind of like, we have to satisfy the audience, and A24 not interested in that in a really powerful way. They want to tell the story, and they want the best story, and they have I think they have a little bit more courage than a lot of other places. There's no question that like Neon's doing exciting work, and there's no question that A24 probably gets credit for movies that maybe they didn't necessarily produce at this point.
All right, I'm out of time. Thank you both very much. The movie's great, and I'm looking forward to seeing it again. Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it.
Such a pleasure.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com. I will link to a bunch of things in the show notes as well, including BJ's Ending Explained piece. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week.
88% of the work week is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
This is the story of the one who, as a maintenance specialist for a historic high-rise, knows that vintage charm historically needs constant attention. Which is why, when it's time to upgrade turn-of-the-century mechanicals, they turn to Grainger. With easy access to a million-plus products and the scale to deliver when and where you need them, the right tools and supplies are never far away. So the one can keep that vintage building running like new. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.